Thank you, ladies, very much. That was beautiful. Always a treat, and it's always an opportunity to speak before you. For those of you that are visiting, the first speaker, the guy with the beard, we are related. The kids he was talking about are my grandchildren. I remember years ago, I lived on the East Coast, and a member bought me and went back. And remember the scripture a day calendars, the flip calendars? Just every day was a new scripture. This one was religious cartoons. One a day, and I'll never forget one of them. And it shows a man looking into a playpen, a crib, and a little baby, it was a cartoon, looking at this little baby staring up at him, and he said, "How's my sermon illustration doing today?" And you use your kids many times for examples. They're right there in front of you. Also, you might see some parallels between the two messages. We did not collude or talk to each other about what messages we were speaking on or the themes, but you might find, some parallels. We take many, many roads in life. Most we do not choose. They are thrust upon us based on our choices or just because of the circumstances involved. When I was in college, a poem by Robert Frost was "The Road Not Taken." How many of you were, that was mandatory? Yeah, look at the hands. Do you know when it was written? 1916. And it was during World War I. It was "The Road Not Taken" was and is a classic. It begins, "Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both. And be one traveler, long I stood, and looked down one as far as I could, to where it bent in the undergrowth." And it goes on. It's a beautiful, beautiful poem in and of itself, with various interpretations. But Paul's last few episodes in the book of Acts are a typical example. In fact, his path after his Damascus Road experience, as it's called, as we'll see in these next few chapters, are examples in the extreme. We would say what we're about to read, Paul's path, his road, his journey, was bumpy, very, very bumpy. Recall Luke in the book of Acts is trying to narrate subjects and events that he heard and saw, was told. And he gives us an idea of what is going on. And in these few verses, these many verses we're going to read today, there is a lot. This is a long set of long narratives, and I apologize ahead of time at the outset. I'm not sure if Mr. Kennedy meant that I was short in my messages. I usually am short. Well, I'm going to ask for forgiveness today, because you're not getting out of here till 6 o'clock. Oh, and I almost forgot. I pulled these bookmarks out of my Bible that Mr. Budge had been using. Almost forgot. I dragged them all the way up here. Here's one. Here's two. And there's a third. And no, you cannot have these. I don't wear these for church anymore. Do you know why? It's very hard to be taken seriously when you're talking about a heavy subject of sin and deprivation and you've got a Mickey Mouse tie on. It kind of loses a lot of the credibility. But we're going to pass these ties out at the door for certain people that can't seem to find a tie in the morning. Just joking. At the end of the day, I don't care. But I couldn't pass it up. So indeed, I apologize at the outset for this extended read here, because this is a lot like a thrilling novel. I hope you agree, and the book of Acts has been exciting for you. It's like a movie. Luke weaves the story with certain word pictures, and he takes great pains for those word pictures. And if you stand back and look at them as we would read a novel, a true novel, no fiction here, it's incredible the pictures that he tries to paint. In discussing with this message with my wife, Becky, who's our theologian, she noted it'd be interesting. I thought this was interesting. She said it would be good to maybe have parts and have people present different parts of the aspects of these chapters. We're not going to do that. But it wouldn't necessarily be that wrong if we did it outside of a church setting. Each participant playing a specific role, because there are some dominant characters in the verses that we're going to read. Everyone plays a role. So today, as we continue to follow Paul in the book of Acts, as he follows Christ in one of the more convoluted and circuitous series, we've entitled it "The Bumpy Road After Damascus." This is the preface. Turn with me, if you would, to Acts chapter 21, where we're going to just do a small recap, because so much happened in the last message, and it's been a while since I've been with you. The place is the Jerusalem temple precincts. Paul has taken a vow with others. The issue is Paul has been accused of defiling the temple with a Gentile. Where that was trumped up from, no one knows. The audience involved, the accusers and the watchers, are mainly Jews, some believers, and Gentiles, including Romans. So let's pick it up in Acts chapter 21, beginning in verse 30. And all the city was disturbed, and the people ran together. And the people ran together. It was just here a minute ago. There it is. Seized Paul and dragged him out of the temple, and immediately the doors were shut. And as they were seeking to kill him, news came to the commander of the garrison that all Jerusalem was in an uproar. He was in charge of the city for the Roman province they were in. It's very important to remember this. The commander of the garrison. He immediately took soldiers and centurions and ran down to them. And when they had saw the commander and the soldiers, they stopped beating Paul, I'll say, because they had something called weapons with them and armor. They stopped beating Paul. Then the commander came near and took him and commanded him to be bound with two chains. And he asked who he was and what he had done. And some of the multitude cried one thing and some another. And when he could not ascertain the truth because of the tumult, he commanded him to be taken to the barracks. When he reached the stairs, he had to be carried by the soldiers because of the violence of the mob. Just picture this. Paul has to be carried out under guard to get to a safe place so they can at least get some information out of him. For the multitude of the people followed after, saying, "Away with him." This phrase is important because it basically means, away with him, he is not fit to live. We will see this twice in this section. It was used of someone else, if you'll recall. Who is that? Jesus. Away with him, meaning he is not fit to live. Kill him. So we pick the story up because he's rescued by another bigwig, a Roman commander of centurions. What's a centurion? A centurion is where we get the word century. A centurion was someone who had command over 100. So the commander is over multiple centurions. He's got hundreds, maybe thousands of men at his disposal. And so it's Gentiles to the rescue again. And we've seen over and over in the book of Acts where Roman officials, city officials, these Gentiles have rescued Paul over and the others over and over again. So let's pick it up in verse 37. Then Paul was about to be led into the barracks. He said to the commander, "May we have a word?" I just can't just picture this. He's being surrounded by guards. The commander's there. Excuse me. Can we talk? May I speak to you? He replied, "Can you speak Greek?" This is because Paul spoke to him not in what? Latin. Did not speak to him in Hebrew, Greek, or Aramaic. He spoke to him in Greek, of all the language to pick. "Are you not the Egyptian," he says to Paul, "who came up some time ago and stirred up a rebellion and led 4,000 assassins out into the wilderness? Are you that guy? What do you say to that?" What's interesting, he doesn't say no, but he gives a positive affirmation of who he is. Paul says in verse 39, "I am a Jew from Tarsus in Cilicia, a citizen of no mean city, and I implore you, permit me to speak to the people." So when he had given him permission, Paul stood on the stairs. Just picture this. He's standing on the stairs ready to address the crowd that's just attacked him. He motioned with his hand to the people, whether he said felicitations, salutations, or he said silence. It's hard to say, but it's a wave of his hand. He spoke to them, this time in the Hebrew language. The word there is the dialecto, which meaning Aramaic. Chapter 22, beginning in verse 1. "Brethren and fathers," can you just picture this? This is the way he starts so many of, "Brethren, fathers," he says to the crowd. "Hear my defense before you now." And when they heard that he spoke to them in the Hebrew language, dialect of the Aramaic, they kept all the more silent. Because he was a man that spoke in their language, because most of them in Jerusalem spoke what language? Aramaic. Then he said, "I'm indeed a Jew, born in Tarsus of Cilicia, but brought up in the city at the feet of Gamaliel." Who is Gamaliel? A famous rabbi that we have much information on. So this is a place name for a Jewish study that they would have understood. "At the feet of Gamaliel. I was a student of Gamaliel." You can just see the crowd. Oh. They knew who Gamaliel was. "Taught according to the strictness of our father's law, and was zealous toward God as you are all today." That's called sucking up. "I persecuted this way to the death, binding and delivering into prisons both men and women, Also, as also the high priest bears me witness and all the council of the elders. Now here at this point, a quick comment. We don't know if the council of elders and the high priest were present there, because it makes a difference if they were in just a little bit. But he gives them as reference, I was on a mission from the council of elders who gave me witness, from whom I have received letters to the brethren and went to Damascus to bring in chains, even those who were there to Jerusalem to be punished. Now at this juncture, what is interesting here is that Paul has not mentioned Jesus Christ's name. He uses this phrase, the way. The speculation is they all knew what the way. Why would he use the word? Paul was no dummy. Paul used words that they would understand. He speaks to the crowd because he knows them, and he uses this phrase, the way. Interesting. Verse 6, now it happened, he goes on, as I journeyed and came near Damascus at about noon, suddenly a great light from the heavens shone around me. And I fell to the ground, hearing a voice saying to me, Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? Those of you that have a red letter Bible, that is in red. So these are the words of Christ. So I answered, who are you, Lord? And he said to me, I am Jesus of Nazareth, whom you are persecuting. So Jesus is now named. What's interesting, the terms that he used, I have a question for you. Biblical Archaeology Review had a recent article. They seem to almost be tracking our study of Acts. How many of you know what BAR is or BAS, Biblical Archaeologists? A few of you do. It's a very interesting. They have an article in there I thought I'd pass along to you. Did Paul fall off a horse? Now you think, what a crazy question. Did he fall off a horse or did he not? They asked this question. At this critical moment when Paul was converted to Christianity, did he fall off a horse? Now I was going to ask for how many hands believe he fell off a horse and how many believed he didn't. How many of you have heard that he fell off a horse? You don't get out much, do you? Two of you? You're kidding. You haven't seen the... This is amazing. Google, did Paul fall off a horse, and stand back. Because the reason is, a good 30 to 40% of Christianity believes he fell off a horse. Do you know why? 600 years of Catholic iconography and art. Cavalleggio did in 1600s did a painting which swept the world of Paul being thrown off his horse on the road to Damascus. Just thought I'd add a little color there, just that you'd find interesting. If not, but Google it. It is amazing. Did Paul fall off a horse? The answer obviously is he did not. So Jesus is talking to him. He says, "It's you. It's me who you are persecuting." Verse 9. And those who were with me indeed saw the light and were afraid, but they did not hear the voice of him who spoke to me. So I said, what shall I do, Lord? And the Lord said to me, arise and go into Damascus, and there you will be told all things which are appointed for you to do. And since I could not see for the glory of the light, being led by the hand of those who were with me, I came to Damascus. Then a certain man, Ananias, a devout man according to the law. Whose law? God's law. Having a good testimony with all the Jews who dwelt therein, he came to me and he stood and he said to me, Brother Saul, receive your sight. And at the same hour I looked up at him and then he said, the God of our fathers has chosen you that you should know his will and to see the just one, another catchphrase for the Messiah in Jesus Christ, that you should see the just one and hear the voice of his mouth. For you will be his witness of all men of what you have seen and heard. And now why are you waiting? Arise, be baptized, and wash away your sins, calling on the name of the Lord. Now it happened when I returned to Jerusalem, Paul goes on. Now keep in mind, as he's telling you this story, the crowd is silent. They're listening with rapt attention. He has said really nothing to offend them. Everything he said is, he knows his audience, he understands his audience, he's using terminology and phrasing that they would agree with. They all waited for a Messiah. And so they sit there listening. You can just picture what Luke is trying to tell us about this big crowd who was ready to tear him apart a few minutes ago is now listening in rapt attention. Now it happened when I returned to Jerusalem and was praying in the temple that I was in a trance and saw him saying to me, red letter again, make haste and get out of Jerusalem quickly, for they will not receive your testimony concerning me. So I said, Lord, they know that in every synagogue I imprisoned and beat those who believe on you. In fact, the crowd, many commentators believe that the crowd that Paul was speaking to were well aware of who he was prior to this. They recognized him. He'd been there before. He was a known entity. He said, And when the blood of your martyr Stephen was shed, I also was standing by consenting to his death and guarding the clothes of those who were killing him. Then he said to me, depart, for I will send you far from here to the Gentiles. Now this is in red because it's the words of Christ, but it's being spoken by Paul to the crowd. Let's read it again in that context. Then he said to them, Paul said to them, depart, for I will send you far from here to the Gentiles. Now at this point, until this word, verse 21 and 22, and they listened to him up until this word. And then when they raised their voices and said, away with such a fellow from the earth, for he is not fit to live. What was that word, brethren? What was the word in all the many dozens of words that Paul used for the time of his speech? What is the word that set them off? Gentiles. The Gentiles. That was too much for them to take. He listened to them until this word. And when they raised their voices and said, away with such a fellow from the earth, he is not fit to live. This is another execution mentioned sentence. He is to be killed. He is not fit to live. Then they cried out and tore off their clothes and threw dust in the air. That's another sign of anger. The commander ordered him to be brought into the barracks and said that he should be examined under scourging. This is a scourging with the flagellum, with the cat of nine tails, with leather straps, with pieces of metal at the end of those straps. The commander ordered that he be brought into the barracks. He brought and examined under scourging so that he might know what they shouted so against him. He wanted to find out the truth. So what do you do? Beat the guy senseless because he'll give it up. This was meant as torture to induce a confession. And as they bound him with thongs, Paul said to the centurion, just picture this if you can that Luke is painting. Paul said to the centurion who stood by, just picture this. Paul is laid out, stretched out, probably on his stomach with his back open. He's naked, probably on this slab of concrete or wood. He's laying there, and he says to the centurion who's about to beat him senseless, excuse me, can I have a word? Or, I can't imagine what's going on here. Is it lawful for you to scourge a man who is a Roman and uncondemned? Now, to do so is against what law? Roman law. You are not to scourge a Roman citizen prior to testimony to beat it out of him. That was against the Roman law. Is it lawful under Roman law for you to scourge a man who is a Roman and uncondemned? And when the centurion heard that, he went to the commander and told him, saying, take care what you do, for this man is a Roman. Can you imagine what's going on here? The centurion is scared to death. He goes to the Roman commander who's over all these people, and he says, be careful, be careful. So it goes on. So then the commander, verse 27, came and said to him, Paul, tell me, are you a Roman? To do so, to claim you were a Roman when you weren't, was subject to what? Death. To claim you were a Roman and you were not. He didn't ask for proof. Their word at that time, such a shame what we've come 2,000 years later. Your word was your bond. Reach in my upper breast pocket over there where you've laid my clothes and you'll see I have a Roman passport. No. Your word was enough. This man is a Roman. He said, are you a Roman? He said, yes. And the commander answered, with a large sum I obtained this citizenship. And Paul said, I was born a citizen. The idea is here is that the commander bought his way into the Roman citizenship. He bribed, which was extremely common at the time. Keep in mind, the centurion is 100 men at his command. He's a powerful individual, and he's flogged probably many, many dozens of people. The Roman commander, has many centurions under his control. This is a powerful, powerful man. And has the power of life and death over Paul. What's interesting is that Paul is using his wits here. He knows not only the law of God, the Torah, he knows Roman law. He's experienced in it because he is a Roman citizen, and possibly. But he's a Roman citizen. He's aware of the Roman law, the rights of citizenship. Going back to BAR again, I kid you not, another recent article had just appeared in the last week or so, entitled Roman Law and Order, Judean Fraud Unit. I'll give you the reference later if you wish. Let me quote, it's kind of a long quote again, I apologize, about this discovery. Quote, a lengthy papyrus found in the Judean desert sheds light on law and order in the Roman provinces of Judea and Arabia. Translated by a joint Israeli-Austrian team and published in the Journal of Tyche, the papyrus dates from between 129 and 132 CE, which is probably around 100 years after the events we're talking about now, and details a gripping legal case involving forgery, tax evasion, and the fraudulent sale of manumission of slaves, in other words, the freeing of slaves. It was a big deal. Tax evasion, forgery, fraudulent sale, and manumission of slaves. According to Avner Ecker, one of the text translators, this is the best documented Roman court case from Judea apart from the trial of Jesus. Isn't it interesting? We get some of the most exact details out of the trial of Jesus that we have read over and over again because Roman law was so important. The claim that Paul makes is a very serious claim. And again, to reemphasize, to say so falsely is death. Notice that he doesn't ask Paul to prove it. He said he was from Tarsus, which was a Roman province. And this throws everything in a new direction because it is pivotal to the entire story in the book of Acts, probably one of the most important sections in all the book of Acts. Out of the blue, this occurs in this Roman legion, this Roman legate rescues Paul. Let's continue in chapter 30. In verse 30. The next day, because he wanted the commander to know for certain why he was accused by the Jews, Paul, he released him from his bonds and commanded the chief priests and all their council to appear and brought Paul down to set him before them. This is another example of the power of Roman law. The Romans could command the Sanhedrin and the council to appear at a moment's notice. That's how powerful they were. Chapter 23. Then Paul, looking earnestly at the council, sat Paul down before them. Chapter 1, verse 23. Then Paul, looking earnestly at the council, remember that phrase, looking earnestly at the council, said, men and brethren, I have lived in all good conscience before God until this day. In other words, why am I here? What have I done? I'm a good person. Notice what next happens. If I can find it. The light's giving me trouble up here. I apologize. Verse 2, and the high priest and Ananias commanded those who stood by Paul, him, to strike him on the mouth. Then Paul said to him, and this is one of the most famous phrases in all the New Testament of what not to do. Don't do this. Then Paul said to him, God will strike you, you whitewashed wall. For you sit to judge me according to the law. And you command me to be struck contrary to the law? This isn't good. This is not good. This is not one of Paul's finer moments of elocution. Who else said something very similar? Remember? You whitewashed sepulcher, you whitewashed wall. Jesus Christ. You're right. There's many parallels. You whitewashed wall, for you sit to judge me according to the law. What kind of law? Biblical law, Torah law. Contrary to the law, you strike me. And those who stood by and said, can you imagine this? He's standing there. Do you revile God's high priest? Then Paul said, I did not know. I did not understand, brethren, that he was the high priest. For it is written, you shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people. This is not good again. He's gone from the frying pan into the fire at this point. He's standing before the commander and his regimen. He's called a council meeting. The council's sitting there. The Sanhedrin is sitting there. And just one disaster after another occurs. Paul is considered a saint, but Paul is not holy. He's not perfect. He makes mistakes, and I want us to remember that. Do you revile God's high priest, he said. Paul said, I did not know, brethren, that he was the high priest, for it is written, you shall not speak evil of God's ruler. Paul loses it and is fired back, brutally. Now, why did he do that? There are four or more theories. Number one, the high priest was unknown to him. It was a different high priest than he was familiar. Two, not wearing his attire. The high priest did not have his attire on, so possibly this was not a normal meeting, and Paul could not recognize him. Three, Paul's eyesight was poor, and he references this in the epistle. And number four, and there's many more, but number four, Paul was being sarcastic. Guess which door I choose? Number four. There's a little bit of sarcasm here. The honorable, it could be interpreted very easily, the high priest I know, the high priest I understand, an honorable high priest wouldn't talk to me like that, would not say such a thing. Again, I checked on two or three different commentaries, and each of them said, this is a bit of undiscovered sarcasm, because Paul knows he is in trouble. He is in deep, deep trouble. The Roman surely doesn't understand what's going on. The Sanhedrin is beyond angry, and Paul must do something. It's turned very, very ugly. He spoke. He knows he's messed up. He spoke rashly. What to do? So he calls an audible at the line of scrimmage. Now, I had to do the football reference after the Super Bowl. To explain what an audible is, for those of you that never played football, there's a huddle. In the huddle, the quarterback usually, he opens up the wrist notes, and there's 2,000 to 3,000 plays. And he calls off to the team, we're running 65 white, red, left, green, blue. Got it? And they go out to the line. The quarterback looks over the opposing defense. He doesn't like what he sees. They're aligned not as he suspected. So he calls an audible. He changes the play right there in midstream. We're doing 65-white, 5-green. You can't believe some of that. Have you ever seen some of the play numbers? They're so complex. He calls an audible. Paul does the very same thing at the line of scrimmage. He scans the room. He notes something very interesting. Verse 6. But when Paul perceived that one part were Sadducees and the others Pharisees, he cried out in the council. Just, again, picture this. He's standing there with his life on the line. He's got nowhere to go. The Jews, the Sanhedrin, hate him. The commander's wondering, who is this guy? Who is this guy? He cries out in the council, men and brethren, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee. Concerning the hope and resurrection of the dead, I am being judged. Do you think this caused peace? Confusion? Or has he done it again? He took a risk. He took a tremendous risk. But he perceives that some are Pharisees, some are Sadducees. How does he perceive it? Their clothing? Maybe the hats? I don't know. We're not told. But some were Pharisees and some were Sadducees. Some feel that the Pharisees dressed one way, Sadducees dressed another. So it may have been more of a formal meeting than we realize. So verse 7. And when he had said this, a dissension arose. That's a bad sign. A dissension arose between the Pharisees and the Sadducees. They did not like each other. And the assembly was divided. And typically, the high priest was a Sadducee. So the assembly was divided. For the Sadducees say that there is no resurrection and no angel or spirit, but the Pharisees confess both. Then there arose a loud outcry, and the scribes of the Pharisees' party arose and protested, saying, can you imagine just... We find no evil in this man. So it's a sign of hope. We find no evil in this man, but if a spirit or an angel has spoken to him, let us not fight against God. So who has he got on his side immediately? The Pharisees. The Sadducees, they aren't his fan. But at least he's got someone in his corner. Now, verse 10, when there arose a great dissension, the commander, fearing that lest Paul might be pulled to pieces by them. Pulled to pieces. Just picture this. The Pharisees want him and the Sadducees are trying to kill him, I guess. He commanded the soldiers to go down and take him by force from among them and bring him back into the barracks. At least he's safe there. What's also interesting about the Pharisees and Sadducees, the Pharisees believed in the oral Torah and all of the Old Testament, most of it that we read. The Sadducees did not believe in any of the prophets or spirits and only the hard oral Torah of the Pentateuch. So they were very, very much divided in what they believed. And Paul took advantage of it. very adroitly. Verse 11. Paul, indeed, at this juncture, we would have to say, is feeling defeated. He has got to believe that this did not go as well as he possibly wanted it to. Nothing went right. He's got the Sanhedrin mad at him. He's got the Sadducees, especially. The Roman official probably has no idea what is going on. Verse 11. But the following night, the Lord stood by him and said, and this is again red letters, "Be of good cheer, Paul, for as you have testified for me in Jerusalem, so you must also bear witness at Rome." This is amazing. What's interesting, the "be of good cheer," obviously Paul wasn't of good cheer. The implication is that he was very defeated, very devastated in what had happened. Again, this did not turn out the way he had wanted at all. But Jesus says, "You have testified for me or of me." The Greek word is a tongue teaser, diamartyromai, to solemnly affirm, diamartyromai, to solemnly affirm, to charge, give solemn evidence, testifying or declaring solemnly. The word, if you notice, the word martyr is in there. And the word martyr, when you read it in the New Testament, means witness. So with all this bad that has happened to poor Paul, Christ stands by him that night. Whether figurative or literal, Christ comforts him. I believe it's literal, and the reason I do is Christ often appears in vision, in the upper room in Jerusalem, on the mountain in Galilee, the road to Emmaus, and elsewhere. I see this very easily, that Christ stood next to him, trying to encourage him, saying indeed, "Be of good cheer, Paul, for as you have testified for me in Jerusalem, so you must also bear witness of me at Rome." He was eventually knew he would be heading to Rome. And Paul, I think, down deep inside, knew this all along. So Christ is with him, encouraging him. And at this point, I said to myself, that's enough. That's a good note to end on. But if you read the rest of it, there's just more. And it just adds to the story and the convoluted nature of it and the bumps along the way. So, sorry, but I felt led to, after I debated on it, places Paul in a certain place, and I wanted him in a different place, as we'll read. Now we're going to read about the plot. We're also going to read about the miracle of the unknown nephew. Have you ever heard the miracle of the unknown nephew? I didn't think so. The miracle of the unknown nephew. So let's pick it up in chapter 23, verse 12. "And when it was day, some of the Jews banded together and bound themselves under an oath, saying that they would neither eat nor drink till they had killed Paul." Now there were more than 40 who had formed this conspiracy. They came to the chief priests and elders. Note, they came to the chief priests and elders and said, "We have bound ourselves under a great oath, and that we will eat nothing until we have killed Paul." Now you notice what happens about the reaction of the Sanhedrin. There isn't any. "Now you, therefore, together with the council, suggest to the commander that he be brought down, Paul be brought down to you tomorrow, as though you were gone to make further inquiries concerning him." In other words, lie. Set him up and lie for us. We call this an ambush. But we are ready to kill him before he comes near. So they want these 40 men who have taken an oath, want the Sanhedrin, the council of elders, including the chief priests, to lie to the commander that they have more questions of Paul. And before he gets there, they will kill him. Horrible. But verse 16, "So when Paul's sister's son, nephew, heard of their ambush," and that's what it's called, "he went and entered the barracks and told Paul." Who? Paul's what? Paul's sister? Paul's sister's son? This is his nephew? We've never heard of this person. We know nothing about him. He said, When he heard of their ambush, how did he hear about it? We're not told. He went and entered the barracks and told Paul. That's interesting. You just walk in and say, "Can I see my uncle?" Sure. And he got in. Then Paul called one of the centurions to him and said, once again, it's a dialogue between Paul and a Roman official, and said, "Take this young man to the commander, for he has something to tell him." So he took him and brought him to the commander and said, Paul, the prisoner, called me to him and asked me to bring you this young man to you. He has something to say to you. Verse 19, then the commander took him by the hand, went aside and said privately, what is it that you have to tell me? What is it that you have to tell me? And he said, the nephew, the Jews have agreed to ask that you bring Paul down to the council tomorrow, as though they were going to inquire more fully about him. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. But do not yield to them, for more than 40 of them lie in wait for him, men who have bound themselves by an oath that they will neither eat nor drink till they have killed him, and now they are ready, waiting for the promise from you. So he's putting the commander on the spot about this ambush. So the commander let the young man depart and commanded him, don't tell anybody about this. Isn't this crazy? It's like a movie. Tell no one that you have revealed these things to me. There's a reason he says that, by the way. There's a very good reason. So we get the picture. There's this plot against Paul that these 40 Jews have put together. What's interesting is we do not hear how the Sanhedrin or the Council of Elders responded. We have not one word. We have no idea what they said. So the commander let the young man said, tell no man what you've told me. Now it gets interesting. We're heading for the home stretch. Verse 23, and he called for two centurions. Note the numbers here. Two centurions, so that's at least how many people? 200. Saying, prepare 200 soldiers. That's why we call him a centurion. Remember that? Century, 100. Saying, prepare 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen, and 200 spearmen to go to Caesarea at the third hour of the night. And provide mounts to set Paul on. There's where Paul gets on a horse. And provide mounts to set Paul on and bring him safely to Felix the governor. Then he, the commander, wrote a letter in the following manner. Listen to this letter that the commander has written. His name is Claudius Lysias. Is this ever... let's just read it. To the most excellent governor Felix. Sorry for the nuance. I can't help it. Greetings. This man was seized by the Jews and was about to be killed by them. Coming with the troops, I rescued him. Having learned he was a Roman, I'm quite a guy. And when I wanted to know the reason they accused him, I brought him before their council. I found out that he was accused concerning questions of their law, but had nothing charged against him deserving of death or chains, according to what? Roman law. And when it was told me that the Jews lay in wait for the man, I sent him immediately to you and also commanded his accusers to state before you the charges against him. Farewell. If we could ever find that letter, would that be an archaeological piece of work? That would be unbelievable. This. Look at all the eyes here. I rescued him. I wanted to know. I brought him before the council. I found out. I sent him immediately. He's quite a guy. He is quite a guy. What's also interesting is where Paul winds up. Verse 31. Then the soldiers, as they were commanded, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris. The next day they left the horsemen to go with him and returned to the barracks. When they came to Caesarea and delivered the letter to the governor, they also presented Paul to him. And when the governor had read it, the letter, He asked what province, this question gets asked a lot. He asked what province Paul was from. And when he understood that he was from Cilicia, he said, I will hear you when your accusers have also come. And he commanded him to be kept in Herod's praetorium. And there we will end it. The praetorium in Caesarea was the official residence of the Roman governor in the Judean province. Located in the palace built by Herod the Great. It was a beautiful facility, and apparently they've excavated the site recently, this praetorium in Caesarea. Paul will be here in this semi-prison for almost the next 2 years. Who else was in prison in a praetorium in Jerusalem? Jesus. So the parallels continue. So let's conclude. What can we summarize? If you were to ask Paul, what would Paul say? What could you learn, Paul? What do you think we should learn from this? Number one, he would say, I don't want to put words in his mouth. First thing you do not do is do not revile the high priest. Not ever. Do not revile the high priest. If you see the Roman commander, make him your ally. Make him your friend. Know how to read a room. Know who has which uniform on which side they're on. It's kind of like another Super Bowl analogy. If you've got the red jersey on and you're throwing to the guys in the green jerseys, that's not good. This seemed to be prevalent in the last Super Bowl. Just saying. If you're the only one in the room without a colorful robe, you're probably in a lot of trouble. That's what Paul would say. He would also say what we can glean. Paul's experience teaches us that we will have felt that we have let God down, that we have disappointed him. I know, and we heard this in the first message, I know and you know that you have said things and done things that have not pleased him, God the Father, or Jesus Christ. We've said things that were inappropriate to people that we did not know or did not understand. And although we do not overtly read Paul's emotions here, because Luke nowhere through this section ever really tells us, he never really tells us what Paul is thinking. We can speculate, but it would be nothing more than that. It would be speculation. He does not tell us for whatever reasons, but he was in a dark moment. He had to be after what had happened. Wouldn't you? The experience that he had with the Romans and the Sanhedrin, the council, was devastating to him. He knew he could do better. But that Christ himself stands with him, and by extension, he stands with us. Though we may feel forsaken, we are not. And all of us at some time have felt forsaken. We are never utterly and completely forsaken. God tells us that over and over again, and I have no less than 6 different verses that say we are never forsaken. We may feel that way, but indeed God never forsakes us. But as with Paul, this is so important. When we look back at this chapter, this couple of chapters, we look back to see a series of miracles. Did Paul understand that they were miracles? Probably not at the time, and not to the extent. He had no way of knowing some of this information. No way at all. But it is indeed a series of miracles. Paul was delivered miraculously, that we've read through the book of Acts, over and over and over again. He's rescued by people who would not normally be considered friends. Non-believers. Romans of all people, the most hated, and as well as Gentiles. They were both. And even his nephew, of whom we know nothing about, appears and never reappears again. A miracle. As with Paul and on his bumpy road, our lives often see this series of events that we had no control over, and yet God is with us, God standing behind us, guiding us all the way. Miracles we see, but I venture to say in your life and my life, we see very few. Lastly, Christ is pleased with us, I think, in trying to speak our faith. As imperfectly as it may be, as with Paul, it does not mean we cannot and should not try. Though we know we must do better, we always hear him say, "Be of good cheer."